Today's Keisho will be on case 34 in the Book of Serenity, Feng Shui's Single Atom. Introduction: Barehanded, empty-fisted, 1,000 changes, 10,000 transformations. Though this is making something out of nothing, what can you do? You employ the provisional to symbolize the real. But tell me, is there a fundamental basis or not? Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. Zhui Du held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants, any beggars? Will die the same and live the same. Verse, as a graybeard rising from a hunt by the Wei River, how does that compare to those who starved in purity on Mount Shuyang? It just lies in a single atom, distinguishing changing conditions. Fame and accomplishment both are hard to efface. Let me just clarify the Feng Shui. This is Master Feng Shui, not Feng Shui, the art of arranging things for the qi to circulate properly. Feng Shui said that, you know, only I'd studied Chinese, everything would be good. Yeah. Said, if you set up a single atom, the nation flourishes. If you don't set up a single atom, the nation perishes. Well, this is really not about nation. He means if you set up a single atom, everything will go well. And if you don't set up a single atom, everything is going to go to hell in a handbasket, basically. And then Zhui Du held up his staff and said, are there any Bhikshuni or Bhikkhu, any followers of the Buddha, who will die the same and live the same. Okay, so that's the koan. So once again, I want to thank everybody for doing such a superb, really superb job this morning. All of you were sitting very deeply and giving it your best effort, and I'm very grateful to you. It's really thrilling to practice with you. The people have been coming into Dokusan, and it's just been wonderful. Everybody's just doing a superb job. It's day for some people. It's day. Let's see. It's day three. For some people, it's day five. So either way, it could be a difficult day. You know, it could be a difficult morning. You know? Because if it's day three, you know, you're probably pretty tired. But you might be starting to feel better. You know, often the first 2 days are the hardest days, and then after that, you might begin to get like your second wind or some energy. But all the same, you know, on the third day of Sesshin, third morning, your legs are talking to you, you know. And if it's day five, you know, basically you probably went through that process a few days ago, where at first you felt like you were run over by a truck, and then you began to feel better. But now, you know, there's an element of you might be a little tired, you know. But please keep going, you know, keep going. We have precious days left and much can be accomplished. It's important you know, to practice regularly. If you practice regularly on, you know, on a weekly basis, on a daily and weekly basis, then these sashins can really pay off in a big way. Also, it's important to, you know, take care of your health. It's actually important to have as good health as you can. And also, it's important to, like, get some exercise. And not during sashin, but you have to sort of be physically fit to do Zen practice, I think. Stamina is part of the picture, you know. But everybody's doing a wonderful job, and I hope you appreciate how happy I am about that. And let me just say, it's important for you to do to make your best effort, you know. And in the morning we have 3 sits in a row with no break. It's possible to get bummed out if you have to take a break. You're trying to sit through 2 sits, or you're trying to sit through 3 sits, and you can't do it, and to be a little bummed out or disappointed in yourself. And I hope that won't be the case, you know, because I've been sitting for 30 some years, you know. So please don't, please understand that I have a lot more practice than other people in the room. So, I don't say, well, why couldn't I do 3 sits this morning? Give it 25 more years, you'll be fine. this is a really, strange enterprise, if you think about it. What we're doing is very strange. And it might not even make much sense, you know, what we're doing. And in Zen, there's a whole tradition of not making sense, you know. We're always telling people, don't use the discriminating mind, and you shouldn't use it when you practice. But it's okay for me to, I think, say a little bit about what we're up to, you know. As I mentioned yesterday, people grow up in a world which seems real, but it's filled with fantasies, you know, and some of these are fantasies of our own making, you know. So we tell ourselves stories to compensate for our setbacks and our defeats, and we try to insulate ourselves from pain. And so yesterday I was saying that part of Zen practice is facing the pain, you know, and that's very important, and it's probably still there today, you know, even after yesterday's talk, you know. And by the way, I too have pain, so please don't think I'm, you know, this morning I'm sitting there. Actually, I was extremely happy on the cushion, so I was sitting there having a wonderful time. That's the truth. But it wasn't painless, you know. I was having a wonderful time, but the pain is there, you know, and so you just have to go into deep mushin. It's not just our own personal fantasies that we are struggling with sometime on the cushion. We're also struggling with other kinds of, like, collective fantasies, you know, that are in culture and language. Just as each person is always telling himself little stories to make himself a little more comfortable, people have always told stories, and passed them on to the next generation. And some of it is like words of wisdom, and some of it is just pure baloney, right? So you know, it's easy to see when we look at other cultures that their, you know, that their beliefs might be ridiculous. So, you know, like maybe the ancient Greeks, when they heard thunder, they hear thunder and they say, "What's that?" And go, "That's the gods, you know, roaring with laughter," or something like that. You know, and of course that's, you know, pure BS, right? You know, and they might not have believed it themselves. You know, in China, people used to think that dragons brought the rain. You know. So I mean, basically, it's pretty clear if we're looking at like ancient Greek mythology that these are preposterous stories and they're not true. You know, and it's clear that dragons don't. It's a cool idea, I must say. I really like the idea that dragons would bring rain, but you know, they come out of the, you know, the idea was they come out of the ocean and then they come over the land and they're shrouded in, you know, conveniently they're shrouded in clouds so you can't see them, right? But they're in there, you know, and there are actually some beautiful paintings by Chinese, great Chinese artists of dragons peeking out. You know, they're really very cute, you know, dragons. And they're peeking out of the clouds, right, you know, and they're fierce but cute, you know, it's very cool. And I actually love dragons, you know, so they come out of the ocean and they're shrouded in clouds and they bring their water beings. These are like ancient beliefs, so they bring the rain. And there, you can't show that they're not there because they're in the, you know, you can't see them, but they're in the clouds. You can look if you can almost see them peeking out, you know. And so, that's it. And the artists actually do them peeking out, you know, and they're looking very. It's very cute, you know. And there's a little tail, really. If you look in art books, you know, Chinese art books, you see there's a little tail over here, and he's looking, and he's got these fierce eyes, you know. But they're loving. They're not like, you know, Western dragons always get killed, you know. Like a Saint George is always running some poor dragon through. You know. But the Chinese love dragons, and so the dragons are cute, and they're up in the sky, and they're helping. See, they help. They don't hurt. They bring the rain that farmers need. So they have a totally different attitude towards. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, there are no dragons. You know? It's a great myth, but so we know that there are no dragons, right? I mean, some people still think there are dragons, but the chances are slim, you know. And we know that probably it doesn't really make much sense to say that the dragons bring the rain, you know. But people probably believe that. A lot of people just, of course, you know. And people probably believed, you know, that, you know, thunder was the gods laughing or bowling or something like that, you know. But when we look at our own culture, it becomes very hard to see how our the way we have constructed like a collective fantasy is false, you know, because it's part of like the reality we take for granted, you know. I woke up this morning and I had a spider bite on my arm, and a spider must have bitten me when I was sleeping. But you know, actually, I love, not only do I like dragons, I love spiders, you know. I think they're so cool. And I think part of the reason I love spiders is that when I was a little boy, I was in my my grandfather's workshop on the farm. And he had next to the barn there was a workshop, and he had tools for the farm and woodworking tools and stuff like that. We were in there getting something, and there were tools. I realize now there was like a clamp for holding boards and things that I, you know, growing up on a military base, nobody had any tools like this. I'd never seen it, you know. So there were all these tools, and there was a lot of sawdust on the floor and stuff, and all of a sudden I looked over and there was this giant spider, you know, and it was coming down, and I just flipped out. I think I probably started crying, you know. I said, "Kill it!" Mm-hmm. And it was either, I can't remember, you know, it was either my grandfather or my uncle, my uncle, but one of them said, "Why would you kill it? Just," he said, "come on, leave it alone, you know, quit messing around, you know." And that left an impression on me. And now I have spiders all over the house, you know, and we don't kill them. People come in and it's like the Addams Family or something. You know? But I love spiders, you know. They're beautiful creatures. Very beautiful. But you're kind of conditioned to be afraid of spiders. You'll hear, you know, people get, when they're growing up, you get a message, "Ooh, it's a spider," you know, and you learn these fears. You learn to be afraid of spiders. I don't think it is instinctual at all, you know. You're taught to be afraid of a spider, and you kill it, you know, and everybody will start trying to kill it, you know. It's amazing, you know. It just has happened in my office. It's like, "Oh, a spider," you know, everybody starts, "Oh my God," it's like, you know, and everybody's rolling up things to hit this poor creature, you know. This is like collective mentality, right? And we form these all the time, you know. And they're in our language too, you know. Words too are just like collective wisdom, you know. They have a lot of the wisdom of our ancestors, and also their foolishness is in there, and their mistake and ideas, you know. So we say, like, we say the sun rises and the sun sets, but it doesn't rise and it doesn't set, you know. Actually, the earth is turning around the sun, you know. So the sun isn't moving at all. It looks like, you know, when somebody first said, "You know what, the earth is not the center of the solar system, the sun is," that person was nearly executed. That's the truth, you know. When people began to say, "We don't think the earth is the center of the solar system," religious authorities and intellectual authorities almost put those people to death. They were so upset. So people have a big stake in making sure these beliefs are respected. It's not just like they get constantly, like, there's the beliefs like, "Oh, it's a spider, kill it," which you learn, you know, in your crib, pretty much. But there's also all these other things that are reinforced by culture at every level, you know. There were other people who reached, you know, the Greeks knew, for example, that the sun didn't move. But for thousands of years after that, people were not allowed to say that the sun is still and that the earth moves and the earth is not the center of the universe. Yeah. When you're trying to find reality, it's very hard to do, actually. And the world we live in is like, some of it's true and some of it's baloney. And the way we even see is, I think, controlled or conditioned by our assumptions, you know. Another good example of this is like vegetarianism. You know, I became a vegetarian about 30 years ago when I killed an animal. I killed a sheep. I was like a hippie, and I wanted to get back to the land. And my wife and I bought a sheep, and we had a friend of ours, Mohammed Swayeh, who was a good friend of ours from Tunisia. And we made a deal. We'd buy a sheep, and he'd show us how to butcher it. And we'd split the meat, and we could put it in the freezer, and we'd have, like, meat to eat. So anyway, we bought this sheep that this woman had raised. She and her husband had decided to raise a sheep for a little extra money. But as she raised the sheep, she began to love the sheep, you know. And then when it was time to sell the sheep, you know, I think she and her husband had a big fight. And basically he said, come on now, it's just an animal. It's just an animal. That doesn't everybody say that? It's just an animal. Even I, have said things like that. Sometimes I was in the, my wife and I were in the grocery store some time ago, and we were getting cat food, and my wife goes through the cans like it's a science, right? So you know we're spending like half an hour getting cat food, right? And we were in a hurry. And you know, she's looking. You know, I don't know if Isidore will like this. You know, this is liver pate. You know, I don't know. He gets very finicky about liver. You know, it upsets his stomach or something. You know, okay. You know, so this is going on and on, right? So I said, "Come on, Barb. It's just a cat." And there were two other. There was a woman. Also, the other one, and she looked at me like, you monster. Said, you bad man. You know? I said, come on, it's just a cat. You know? I said, ah, you monster. So anyway, there are animal lovers, but they're, you know, like pet lovers, right? But you know, the sheep are raised, sheep are not pets. Sheep are livestock, right? We have these categories. So the sheep was raised for livestock, it's not a pet. And she, you know, so anyway, we bought the sheep, we put it in the truck, and I could see this woman crying as we drove away, and the sheep was going, mom, mom, you know. So we took it out and slit its throat, you know. And I was so depressed after that. I just said, I will never do this again, you know. And I did. I'd like to say that from that very day, but it didn't happen like that. But I just began to become a vegetarian, and I became a vegetarian. And yet, you know, even to this day, you know, in the West, especially in the Western world, a meal is meat with ornaments, right? So when I grew up, we used to have roast beef or pot roast or different kinds of meat items, and then we might have like a few vegetables and a potato, right? So it was like, what's with the meat tonight, you know? Or actually, it didn't really matter. That little rice-a-roni is what we used to eat. Rice-a-roni and a piece of meat, and we might or might not eat the vegetables, and your mother would say, now eat the vegetables, but we all knew the meat was the real meal. See, this is all culture, right? So even now, when I'm a vegetarian, like a total vegetarian, and people will say to me, you know, your health is going to give out, man. You know, even my wife says this. You know, I've been a vegetarian I go to the doctor and I have like perfect blood pressure, you know, and she goes, you should eat some meat, you know, you're going to be sick, you know. So it's that cultural thing, right? You've got to have meat, you know, you'll die. You're not getting any protein. You know? Okay. So you know, basically, Zen, there's many different ways to meditate, you know, but Zen, Buddhism is based upon prajna, or prajna, which is, you could translate as knowledge or wisdom. In religion, or if you want to think of Buddhism as a religion, there's like two branches. There's like bhakti or devotional practice, and there's practice which is based upon knowing. And Buddhism is really like committed to like prajna, a knowledge. Right? We're going to try to see things as they really are. There are devotional schools of Buddhism that are sort of late developments, but there's not much devotionalism in Zen. But you know, this is really based upon knowing about what's real, and so it takes a long time to encounter the real, because we have all of these. Fallacies that are part of our world. Some of them are personal fallacies, and some of them are like, you know, cultural fallacies, fantasies, you know. And also, our minds are not usually in such good shape, you know. In other words, you know, a lot of people are, you know, haunted by psychological disabilities. So, you know, people go around all day thinking, oh, I'm going to kill him, you know. They go around all day, like, playing these mental tapes in their heads of, you know, I'm mad at him, or I want to be a millionaire, or, you know, all of this stuff, you know. And so if you could, you know, hook up somebody's brain to, like, a screen, it would be horrifying, right? Because probably there'd be a lot of sex and violence, you know. There'd be a lot of you know, junk, you know. There'd be, you know, and it wouldn't be like a movie. It would be like there's this image of somebody getting hit in the head with a hammer, right? There's this image of lunch. There's this image of mom, you know, and with a pie in her hand or something. There's this image, you know. And then, you know, it's just jumping, you know. So the average mind is very unfocused. It's in the moment, it's in a fantasy, it's angry, it's happy, it's thinking about the future, it's in the moment, you know, so on and so on. So the average mind is very hard, really, to encounter reality at all. Because the world we live in is like, a lot of it's like, dream, sort of semi-dream, it's like fantasy, it's like memory, and these powerful emotions. And you know, this is why, you know, basically, I think something like science really helped people, I think, because it said, look, you know, let's try to find out what's actually happening, you know. So you say that if I leave a pile, you know, Western people used to believe that mice were created, like if you left a pile of rags in the corner, they would turn into mice. Really, it sounds ridiculous, but people believe this, you know. This is a spontaneous generation. Because people notice, like, a dead fish, you know. There's a dead fish one day, and the next day there were maggots in it. And they came by and said, my God, of course, the fish has turned into maggots. It's clear, right? It's obvious. We know now that that doesn't happen. You know, if you put the fish under a bell jar, the maggots never form because the mosquitoes, you know, but people didn't approach things that way because they were like on the edge of insanity a lot of the time, right? So scientists came along and said, well, let's try to test things and just see what's actually the case. So science is, that's a good idea, you know. So, actually, what we're doing isn't really like a science in a certain way because, is like a science in a lot of ways. What we're doing is like a science in a lot of ways because, you know, we too are trying to say what's really happening. And our method is a little different from science, though, because instead of trying to just do experiments in the real world, we're trying to correct, like, the experiencer's mind. Before we do the experiment, we want to have the appropriate mind, right? So what we have to learn how to do is to have a calm, focused mind that's able to stay in the moment long enough to notice things. It's not like hysterical or driven by fantasies or so frightened that it can't perceive, or, you know. So a lot of Zen practice at first is just training the mind. We pick an object like the breath and we say, let's just try to train the mind to just be focused on the breath. And it's, as you know, it's very difficult to stay focused on an object for, say, 8 or 10 seconds over and over again. Because, you know, there's all these fantasies, you know, music running in your head, you know, and also all the psychological elements. You're sitting there thinking, oh, I'll never do this, I'm no good, you know. Or you're sitting there thinking about an argument you had with your brother before you came to Sesshin, and you're replaying it, you know. So eventually, though, if you keep watching your mind, You know, all of a sudden, your mind starts resting serenely in the moment. And usually it's because, you know, you're struggling with pain. But all of a sudden, you start having these periods where you're just in the moment. And the thoughts are very few and far between. Yeah? Very few and far between. And this might seem trivial, but it's an enormous achievement. One in a million people is capable of doing this. You know, it is not being, if they could hook your head up to a big screen, you know, what somebody would see is not like these hysterical flashing images and so on, but they'd just see like the floor, be like a camera pointed at the floor, and there'd be a little soundtrack, right? And the soundtrack would be of a bird singing, right? So you'd think, well, this, not much is going on in this movie, but, you know, there'd be a camera pointed at a floor, and then there'd be a bird, and then the floor, you're still staring at the floor, and you hear another bird, and then the car goes by, and then you're still staring at the floor, right? You know? And you wouldn't stay for that movie, right? But achieving that is really wonderful. That's like really an enormous step forward, you know? And of course, then the fantasies start for a while, but then you come back and there's these intervals where you're just in the moment. And very few people ever achieve this. And when you can stay in the moment for a little while, it's so healing, you know? You suddenly hear that, you normally just say, oh yeah, there's a bird, you know, but you're sitting there and you hear that bird and it's so fresh and clear. It's so beautiful. It's just, you know, heaven, right? And this is the beginning, being able to do this is the beginning of Zen practice. It's the beginning of our prajna, yeah, of our knowledge or our wisdom. And it requires a change in how we experience the world, but we're going right to the actual experience. See, what's actually happening at this moment. And, you know, so Zen is not like philosophy, you know. I thought it was. When I started doing Zen, my teacher said, I want you to work on the breath koan. And I thought, yeah, sure. I'll do the breath koan. And I started, you know, watching my breath and thought, well, this is stupid, you know. And then I'd go in and see him and say, all is one, you know, all is one. You know, I didn't understand, you know. I was still sitting there like in my fantasies and churning them out as fast as I could. You know. But the point is to be in the moment without all of these projections and all of our crippling anxieties and self-doubts and so on. The sheer presence of the world is astonishing, right? The Buddhists have a word for this, which is tat-ata. Tat-ata is pure presence. Pure presence. And all of Buddhism is based upon the experience of tat-ata. And the Buddha himself was called the Tathagata, similar word. The Buddha was people who met him were, very moved by his lack of fantasy, you know, his incredible presence and his ability to be present without projecting, without fantasy. This is the foundation of Zen practice. And Mushin is very, very important. For many reasons. It's one of the ways we can free ourselves from all of these entangling fantasies and projections. But actually, it's an element of reality itself. People are so distracted and fearful that they can't really look at the moment long enough to see what it's like. But if you watch your breath long enough, sooner or later, your mind, what we call your mind, is going to become blank and dark. Basically, you're probably going to notice that you keep going to this blank place. Now, where that blank place is, you should not try to decide yet, okay? We say it's in my mind, but who knows? That could just be language deceiving us again, okay? So everything is then based upon direct experience. So if I said to you, where is that blankness? And you said, it's in my mind, I don't think I would necessarily believe you, you know? So I might ask you to investigate and tell me where it is, you know. And we have all these assumptions. There's in the mind and there's the real world, but those may not be true either. I'm not trying to sell you anything. Just experience the moment as it actually arises without presuppositions, without assumptions. And so, you know, the Zen practice is trying to get you to clear away the assumptions and then experience the moment as it actually arises, what's actually here now, not what people told you should be here, not what even language, but sometimes things will happen to you on the cushion for which you don't even have good words. But that doesn't mean they're not real. You know, physicists have this same problem. You know, they're trying to they say there's an object that has no weight, but it has mass. You know, I was awake that day in class, in science class, and I remember, you know, mass is very much like weight, I think, you know. But actually, you can have something that has mass, but no weight, you know, and that seems impossible. And so scientists made up a word called a boson. It's not a guy on a ship, it's in physics, you know, so a boson, you know. And they could have just called it they make up words like quark, you know, a quark. You know, the problem is words don't work. You know, we don't have any words for this stuff. You know, and it doesn't, they don't necessarily, but it's real. There's something there that's really like that. You know, electrons. You know, when I was in school, we studied electrons, and we were taught that they look like little satellites going along around a planet, but I've talked to people who have looked at, I talked to a person once who looked at an electron microscope, and he said that's not really how electrons look. He said very hard to describe. So we don't always have words for what's real, you know. So in Zen practice, you know, where the koans are trying to get you to notice something about the moment. Or often, they're not always doing that, or they're always doing that, but they're doing that in different ways. Koans are trying to get you to notice something about the moment, and they're also trying to get you to use your big, what we call your big mind, to draw on your unconscious mind, which often notices things that your conscious mind screens out. So, you know, you might walk into a room and suddenly go, you all of a sudden you feel panic, you know, and you start thinking, fire. Right? You walk into a room and you start feeling panic and you think, fire. And the reason is that you smelled something that was burning, right? But you might not have pieced it together logically. It's just like your big mind immediately sent a jolt of adrenaline into your system, and then your little mind said, "Oh, why am I so excited? Uh-oh, you know, fire, you know." So this is very common, right? Zen is using your big mind takes in more information than your conscious mind, and it's using all the inputs from all your senses without letting the little mind in the way too much. Get in the way. It's kind of saying, get out of the way. So you can process all this information and experience something in the moment. And there's the little mind is saying, oh, there's nothing there. I know there's nothing there because that's what I learned in school, you know. don't listen to that little mind. Sometimes when people are watching their breath, it doesn't seem to be going out their nose at all. Now we know the breath has to either go out your nose or your mouth. But sometimes you could swear it's going out your eyes, see, or your forehead. Now you're not, it's not going out, literally, you know, it's not going out your forehead, but something is happening that you need to pay attention to when it feels like you're going out your forehead. Something real is happening. We just don't necessarily know what it is. But it's very good to pay attention to what's actually happening. Yeah. So, when you're in deep samadhi, you feel like you're floating off the cushion. Now, there are people who have actually concluded that humans can levitate. And the Maharishi Mahesh, his organization, used to try to get photographs of people levitating. They really aren't very far off the ground, and if you look at them, it really looks like they're trying to bounce up and down, you know. I personally don't think people can levitate, you know. But when you're on the cushion, and it feels like your body has disappeared, you may feel like you're floating. A camera would show you're still on the cushion, but it's something real is still happening, you know. And what's happening is that you're processing information in a whole different way. You're even processing your body's information in a different way. So it's like your brain is now processing in a different way. It's like you're a different creature. You're a different kind of creature now. And so, basically, Zen practice is about breaking through these barriers, personal and emotional, cultural, and experiencing the real. And it is very much like the story of the blind man and the elephant. You know, each of these koans is saying, please notice something about reality. You're a blind man, and you go up to the elephant, and you grab the leg, and it feels like a tree. And so you say, I think it's a tree. You know, and that would be a correct answer, right? Another person goes up and says, I think it's like a snake because he has the tail, and so on. This parable, this story of the blind man and the elephant was actually invented by Buddhists in India. It might even come from the Buddha. He was trying to say this process is like groping a little bit blindly, but gradually you are encountering for yourself in your own, nobody told you this was true. You're encountering something on the cushion. And part of it is working against, presuppositions, just like in science, you know. You might not know what to make of it. You know, I mean, even in science, people have a hard time, you know. So I was reading this thing. There was a guy, I think it was the early 20th century, who had a map of the world, and he noticed, you know, that if you take South America and you put Africa next to it, they fit together almost perfectly. And he realized that all the continents, the shapes of the continents actually fit together, sort of. And he went ahead and cut them out, and he tried to put them together like a puzzle. And he said, all of these continents were really once part of a big continent. And he wrote an article, and the whole scientific community told him he was insane, right? And he was an idiot, and so on. But you know what? It's true. It turns out that is indeed the case. And since then, geologists, poor guy, he went to his grave being ridiculed. But another case is this guy who discovered ulcers. You know, he found that for years everybody was told ulcers were caused by stress. And people would be told, don't get excited, you know, you've got to get more rest, take it easy, drink warm milk before you go to bed, no spicy food. And people would do all this and they still had ulcers. And it turns out that, like, you know, 80-90% of ulcers are caused by intestinal parasite, actually, you know, like a little bug that gets into your system you pick up from flies landing on your food. This guy too published this article and everybody laughed at him, said, "You're an idiot," you know. So it's hard to work against collective wisdom, but the interesting thing is that when you encounter the real, I think you feel better. You know, because the world is really our home. You know, we really belong in this world, you know. And when we encounter the real, it's somehow very liberating, and it's deeply refreshing, and I think it brings a lot of joy. Because it's like coming home, right? You feel this deeper sense of the interconnectedness of everything. And I think when people live in shrouded in fantasy, they feel safe, but it makes the world very fragmented, and it makes the world fragmented. You know, it's like, you know, I have to confess that for years and years, my wife and I have fed raccoons. And we, in our old house in Highland Park, one time, it was like a dream. Because we used to throw food for the raccoons, and they would all tell their friends, you know, "I swear this is the truth. I swear it." A friend of mine named Chris Anderson was visiting with us, and he wrote a book called Edge Effects. Edge Effects, and I think he actually talks about this in the book. But he was staying with us, and we said, "Well, we're going to go feed." He's a nature lover too, so we said, "We're going to go feed the raccoons." And we went out the back door, and there's like 25 raccoons out there, and our cat would sit on the picnic table, and he wasn't afraid of raccoons at all, and they didn't mess with him. He'd just sit there. He looked kind of like a raccoon too, as a matter of fact. He's deceased now, but he had the same markings and everything. And basically, they were like, it was like, "Oh my God, how many raccoons are out there?" You know, and they all had like little bibs on. You know. Now it is true that, you know, some raccoons, they do carry rabies, you know. And indeed, rabies does terrible things to their population. They'll have a population crash because of rabies. And so, you know, actually a few years later, there were hardly any raccoons because of some disease that swept through their community. And also they do carry a parasite that is very dangerous to humans. It's unlikely you could get it, but, you know, you should always wash your hands. And be careful if you leave bowls out. You should sterilize those bowls because the parasite is impossible to get rid of if it gets in your system, and it's very serious. So those are things are true, but you know people don't know those things. It's just like raccoons. You know, "Oh my God!" You know, they immediately want to call the police and have the raccoons arrested. But you know, why do we feed these raccoons? I think people have, we go out there and we feel so happy, you know, being connected to the raccoons. And, you know, people get out in the woods and there's trees and the birds, and this is our home, you know. We feel so alive. You know, and I think this is one of the things the Buddha, this is why the Buddha taught, you know, basically, the Buddha said, you know, let's try to understand reality. Because if we do that, we'll be happier, not sadder. And we'll be more connected, not less connected. You know, many people think, well, reality is unpleasant and not a good thing. Let's live in fantasy. And the Buddha said, really, the most amazing thing of all is the real. The most beautiful thing of all is the real. And the truth is that this whole world is like our body. This world is our life. You know, and we could have such a rich life if we could get out of these dreams. You know, we think the dreams make life rich, but it's not true. You know, all this world is like our own body. This world is our own life. Every bird, every blade of grass is our own life. This is the truth. And Zen is all about experiencing the world as self, which is not a fantasy. It's the way things, the way things really are. And the world is quite different, ultimately, than what people think. Quite different. The Buddha said, the ordinary people live in a world that's upside down. As a famous, he used to say, the views of ordinary people are upside down. You know, and another way to put it is the views of ordinary people are not totally wrong, but it's like having a few pieces of a puzzle on the table, but all the other pieces are missing. So if you just have a few pieces of the puzzle, you look and you see a nose, and you look and you see an eye, and you say, it's President Bush, you know. But when you put it together, it has nothing to do with President Bush, you know. It's the Mona Lisa or something else. You know, it's something quite different. So the world as it is really is quite different from what people think. Fortunately, right? Fortunately. And so, this is what we're doing. You know, please go home. I don't mean leave. I mean, because actually where you live might not really be your home, actually, you know. The world is your home, but you have to be in the right, you have to have eyes open. We say your dharma eye has to be open. You have to have eyes open, free from haunting fantasies and projections. And then free from presuppositions and prejudices. And you start experiencing the real, and it's like, oh, this is thrilling. Feng Shui said, if you set up a single atom, everything's going to be, if you focus on this moment, everything is going to be great. And if you don't, it's a madhouse. Zhuaido held up his staff and said, are there any mendicants who will die the same and live the same? In other words, are you ready to join the world? Are you ready to be one with the world? Your life is my life. My life is your life. The bird's life is my life. We all live one life and die one death. Yeah? Together. This is together, 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 together. Everything is together. So let's enjoy it. Let's go. Let's open doors and find out just how wonderful this world really is.